This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And at the bottom of the hour, I am going to be talking to Georgiana Marie, who has written a book for writers. It's called Improv for Writers, 10 Secrets to Help Novelists and Screenwriters Bypass Writer's Block and Generate Infinite Ideas. Woo! Okay, that should be fun. I never get writer's block. I have the opposite. I have like nonstop flow of ideas. But anyway, this is going to be fun. But meanwhile, right now in the studio, I have with me Bill Larson, our own legal eagle, who's going to answer some of your intellectual property questions and legal questions, and because we don't want anybody to get into trouble. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with one that I have to be careful, too, of this because I don't want to get in trouble on my website. Writers, she's written a mystery, and the mystery is based in a hotel.
Okay.
A real hotel. Mm-hmm. And I think it's sometimes really a great idea to base your books on a particular place, a real place. One of my favorite romance authors, Kelly Abel, she sets her books up in Florida, here in a city called Monticello. Monticello, Florida, and her books, they're all about an Irish pub and an Irish family, but it's set in town. And it turned out, at the beginning when she wrote the first book, she didn't realize she was going to be such a success and keep writing, you know, books about Monticello. But it was, and it has turned out to be a great thing for her because the little city has embraced her. I mean, they really like her. You know, they feature her books, and mm-hmm. you know, she's invited to speak up there all the time. And I'm sure they're going to declare a Kelly Abel Day, and mm-hmm. and maybe, you know, after she hits like 100 books and sells 100 million books, they'll do a statue to her because people, her fans, and she has a lot of them. Romance authors have dedicated fans. I mean, they really do. It's like the Field of Dreams. You know that movie. People go to the Field of Dreams. It's out in the middle of nowhere.
They're considering having a professional baseball game there next
year.
Yeah.
And so in this case for Kelly, I think it was very clever. But now an author wrote to me, she's done a murder mystery in a particular hotel. And the reason she did it there is everything sort of played out, the locations and the what's in the hotel she thought was ideal. And she went a couple of times while she was working on the book. And she took a lot of photos. But now she's wondering if, because it is a murder, it's not a cozy mystery, it's a real murder mystery. Is she going to get in trouble if she uses the photos that she's taken of many of herself, sometimes what she did, she said at one point she one of the weapons that was used in the murder, she actually put on the banister of the hotel and took a picture of it. So now it's occurred to her, is she going to get in trouble for using the name of a real hotel? And if she has the photos of even herself standing in front of the hotel?
Question of degree.
Yeah.
Now, if it's nothing but nice statements about the hotel, they're probably not going to get too upset, right? There's no disparagement. The question is whether or not it creates a disparagement to the trademark or the name brand of the hotel. On the one level, in the writings that she has, but then on the second level, the photograph. Okay, so the photograph of the hotel with the knife there could be disparaging, right? It could dissuade people from going to that hotel because they may believe in their mind that it's a dangerous location. So it's always a question of degree, all right? And that's not easily answered. So if you want to 100% avoid any problem, then make up a fictitious name of a hotel. If you're going to use the name of a name brand hotel, then you should tread lightly, because if they don't like it, they may come and say, we don't like it and we want you to use something different. Whether or not a jury would find it disparaging is anyone's guess, because it is a level of degree, and so there's no clear answer. If you want to be 100% free, don't do it. If you want to take a little risk, and because it increases the plot or increases the realism of your story, then do it and see what happens. But there's no clear answer.
Okay, because I know that people have said books, for example, in Jekyll Island, Ghost Stories. You know, there's a lot of ghost stories.
A lot of great movies are set in great buildings around the country. Okay,
yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of times they change the name. You know, particularly if people are getting thrown off the top of the building,
yeah.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, so they've done stuff like that. But you know, clearly you can recognize the building, right? You know what the Empire State Building looks like. You know what a lot of famous buildings look like. And obviously, the owners of the buildings are concerned that it might spill over into somebody honestly believing that it's true, and then tarnish their reputation. So it's one of degree, and every different brand owner has a different view of it, right? If you show, you know, a terrible scene of people getting machine gunned to death in front of a McDonald's, they're probably not going to like that in your movie, right? So a lot of times you'll see movies, they'll have a fictitious restaurant where these things occur and not real, because they are concerned that it may disparage the reputation of the brand.
Well, I know when we shoot a film, and I've been involved in some, you know, when we've shot films, we are very careful about getting permission.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, we shot a film in a house downtown, actually. And it's the family was all for us shooting the film there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, our people, the film people, went in, the producer and all of us. And right away, we started looking around and we see all these things that we can't shoot.
Right.
I mean, just simple things like art on a wall.
Mm-hmm.
We realize that we can't do that.
That can constitute a copyright infringement.
Exactly. And people don't realize sometimes how it works. Because, I mean, you think that a picture on the wall, it's a famous picture, it's well known.
And there's been considerable litigation over that, where famous pictures have been in the background of movies. And it goes both ways. Sometimes the jury says, nah, it's not really a big part of it. You know, it's just a glancing view. And in other cases, it's different. You know, in terms of using, you know, names or cities or stuff like that, I was watching Jaws the other night, okay? One of the great movies of 1975, probably one of the greatest. And they takes place in Amityville. Well, Amityville's not a real city, right? It's Martha's Vineyard. But somebody made a conscious decision not to use Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, yeah.
Right? For a shark movie for history.
I
so
bet,
they created
I
Amityville.
Bet.
And somebody thought about that and said, you know, is this going to disparage the city? Is this going to, you know, hurt their reputation?
Oh, yeah.
So
you
have to take that.
And in Martha's Vineyard, per capita, there must be, like, so many lawyers in that little area.
It's a beautiful area.
I love it. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Gorgeous. And so I was thinking of this as I was watching the movie again the other night. About, you know, changing the names of cities, changing the names of buildings, restaurants, hotels, whatever it may be, just to be on the safe side, because so you don't want to leave a lasting impression in somebody's mind, because people are impressionable. They may see that. And obviously in movies, it's more vivid than in a book. You know, they can get that picture and unconsciously have a negative effect on the goodwill of that brand,
yeah.
Just because that person now associates this bad incident with that particular brand name. So it's...
You don't know, and it's funny. I mean, when you think of, like, we're talking today we're going to talk about another case, and it's funny, like, I mentioned the Field of Dreams. Who would have thought, when they made that movie, that field would
become so famous, and people would, I mean, they go to it like it's a religious,
it is.
Mecca.
I mean, I actually, you know, I love baseball. I love baseball, and I do see myself going there and playing baseball. I'd love to go.
I would love to go watch a game there.
I would.
It's almost becoming like an American Idol.
Yeah.
And it's just idealistic era with the farming and the baseball, everything that we consider, you know, Americanism.
Yeah. But well, that's that is the power of fans, of right. whether it's a movie or a book.
And it shows the power of their movie, because the book would never have raised that kind of interest. It was the vivid views and the screenplay and the brilliant movie. Videography of that movie that made it so special, not to mention the great cast.
Yeah, exactly. So, you never know, and this is the funny thing in life, you never know. And there is another, talking about Field of Dreams, there's a book called The Art of Fielding, and it's a novel by Chad Harback. Mm-hmm. And it's also gone into some interesting...
Here's an HBO show or HBO movie.
Yeah.
And so apparently, from what I've gathered, it looks like they were working with the author to create either a movie or a TV movie. And then I guess they went another direction and they created a movie called... They gave it a different name. Instead of The Art of Fielding, they called it Bucky's Ninth. And so it's not clear to me completely where they went different directions. But in any event, the author sued, and the case was dismissed. Apparently, the judge did not feel that there was sufficient copying or substantial similarities between the underlying work and the Bucky's Ninth, which was the accused infringing work. Apparently, it's on appeal. I don't know where it stands right now. But this is one of those cases where it's not clear where the line stands between copying and new original work.
And one of the things, as you've mentioned before, that authors should keep track of their work, keep a record of when they write something, and date it, and mm-hmm. have this yep. ongoing thing.
So if you are an artist or an inventor or an artist, when you complete a day's work, you should sign and date it on the bottom and store it in a place where no one can get at it. That's very important evidence when we go, if we have to sue. We show that the work was kept secret, and a signature and a date is very important. That's considered very strong evidence. So I tell this to my inventors. If you're creating something in the laboratory, you have your lab book. Every day you date it, you sign it, and you put it in a locked cabinet. And the authors should do the same as they progress through the creation. Mailing it to yourself is not considered really good evidence.
No.
People call it the poor man's copyright. It doesn't exist. It's an urban legend. It has no basis in law. If you want to protect your work, keep it secret, date it, sign it, and then file periodic copyright applications. All right. Now, the copyright applications is your best way to prove the date and time that you were working on the piece. All right. And you don't have to complete the work to file your copyright application. You can file when you're halfway done and three quarters of the way done, and when you're all the way done as you progress.
Okay. Most people don't realize it. They
right.
think,
you don't have to
I
wait
have to
the
have
end.
All 600 pages done.
No, you don't.
And you don't.
You don't. So if you want to create something where, and a lot of masterpieces take years to create. You know, they start writing something or painting something, and they pick it up 3 years later. And if that's true, then you can file these copyright applications to protect what you have so far. And that is your best evidence when you get into court to show the progress of the work.
And, of course, nowadays, the problem is for so many people, you know, you have everything on your computer. And I can't tell you how many authors I have met and talked to, and they don't have any written copies. Mm-hmm. They have the most right. current one.
So but they should.
They haven't saved the first version, the second, which I
do that. I'll actually, when I'm writing a legal brief, okay, I'll get to a certain point, and I'll save it to my computer, but also print it.
Exactly.
Okay.
You have to.
I take the paper and I just stick it aside, because what if the building burns down? What if the computer crashes? At least I've got it in this piece of paper and I can go, you know, recreate it.
And I was involved in a lawsuit where we actually, we had to prove that a document was printed.
Mm-hmm. And you could do that by looking into the bowels of the copier or the printer.
No, it was funny. The person had printed a document, but of course it was dated like years before, mm-hmm. but we had to prove, and we had to get forensic, and it was a very expensive process mm-hmm. to get forensic analysis done, that the type that was used, that he used to print that document mm-hmm. did not exist
right.
on the date that
right. so it was a
yeah I mean it was
fraud
obviously
forgery,
fraud
right.
and obviously forgery mm-hmm. but that just, I'll never forget it. That forensic analysis was like, 180 pages and cost a fortune. To prove that.
And we do that a lot in our litigation, and the costs are enormous.
Enormous. I mean, I thought this forensic guy, he is going to be buying a Porsche, you know, because he
probably already has three.
Yeah, exactly. So do that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Make sure that you print it, save it, keep it.
And two things that'll help your lawyer if we have to sue for you to prove, you know.
Yeah.
And if you come with me with no good evidence, you make my job harder to prove your case.
Yeah, because you never know. Also, and this is somebody asked me to ask you about estate planning. One of the things is you might write a book today and then you drop dead. But actually, years later, somebody discovers this book. Some actress is reading this book and says, yee, my, I want to play this part. Mm-hmm. She then goes to your estate to buy the book, the rights, and suddenly your
heirs get rich.
Your heirs get rich.
Yep.
But you need to have this
documented. Yeah. It's the same thing. Just create documents. It's just at the end of every day, just either print it, sign it, something. Do something other than just write and put it down. And so that if we look at it later, we can't tell when you started, when you stopped. Was it years? Was it a day?
Yes. Well, and that reminds me, I just wanted to mention to your wife, Mickey, who is a great fan of Margaret George. Margaret wrote her first book, Henry VIII, 612 pages, by hand. This was a few years before, you know, computers were very popular, and she actually didn't know how to type. So she wrote 612 pages by hand, and she still has it. Then she rewrote it again as she, you know, edited it herself. So she has all this evidence, which is why, you know, people, students who are working on their PhDs flock to Princeton University to read F. Scott Fitzgerald's original manuscripts. And unfortunately, with this generation of authors, we won't have that kind of thing. It'll all be printed, and they won't have very few authors, you know, still write by hand. But it's funny how I was talking to her, and she said she has it all, you know, there in all handwritten.
We have the same thing with the Declaration of Independence, where Jefferson first wrote it, and then Franklin came in and edited it. And so we can see the progression of where it started and where it ended and how the two collaborated to create the perfect document.
And it is fascinating. Well, that's why I guess I keep doing F. Scott Fitzgerald over and over. But I mean, really, if I get one more thesis on F. Scott Fitzgerald, I'll go crazy. That's a little bit. I think there are now like maybe 850 PhDs based on F. Scott Fitzgerald's writings, which, you know, but.
So I have a couple of important updates here on copyright law. The Supreme Court came out with two major rulings on copyright law. There had been a split in the circuits, and when I say a split in the circuits, most people don't realize that depending on what court you're in, federal court around the country, they could have different opinions on what the law means. So if you sue in California or you sue in Atlanta, those courts were split. In other words, they had completely different views of the law. And that's why we have the Supreme Court. So when we have all these different courts that say, no, this is what it means, no, that's what it means, the Supreme Court says, all right, everybody, hold on, give me the case, and they come out and tell you what the law is for the whole country now. So there's no more difference of opinion between the or among the federal district courts. And one is very important, and it concerns how you file a lawsuit. We have to remember that although copyright is afforded as a matter of law from a constitutional principle, from the time you create the work as an author, there's a second part to it, okay? And that's the part where you file a copyright application and get it registered. Well, for a long time, there was a question of whether you could file a copyright application, a lawsuit after filing an application, or you had to wait till registration. That was the split in the circuits. And the Supreme Court came down and said, no, you have to have a registration. The mere filing of an application for copyright is not enough. You have to have a registration. Well, taking into consideration that it takes about 12 months for your application to proceed through the Copyright Office to registration, that's a lot of time that could go by, you know, when somebody infringes you. So again, file early, file often. That's what I tell a lot of clients. Just when you get to a point, file it because it's going to take a while. And then if somebody steals it from you, you have your registration and you can move very quickly to stop them. Because the more time the defendant has to gain momentum on an infringement, the harder it is to stop them. All right, so that's a very important new rule of law. The other Supreme Court case that came out just recently, the Supreme Court ruled concerning what costs mean in a copyright infringement case. Copyright infringement cases are very dangerous for defendants because in copyright law, costs mean not only the cost that you pay experts and the cost you do to fly around and take depositions, but also includes attorney's fees. Okay, so it's a very strong plaintiff's case, and it's very, you know, in a lot of cases you can get a very low damages award in a copyright case, but you have $1 million in attorney's fees and deposition fees and all these other costs, and you want to recoup that money, because if you spend $1 million on your lawsuit and you only get $100,000 in damages, you lost, right? You're upside down $900,000, and so it's been a new ruling in by the Supreme Court to kind of bridle back the amount of costs you can get, but it's still an important issue for folks to remember. Get your copyright application in early, get it registered, hang on to that registration, and remember, if you're in a lawsuit, you have a very strong position, because I defend a lot of copyright lawsuits, and I tell my clients, yes, you probably will not get whacked for huge damages, but if you lose, even for a dollar, you're paying freight for the other side, and that could be financially devastating.
Okay, well, it's something to consider. And all of you out there, the best thing is to have a lawyer right from the beginning. And if you want a great lawyer, call Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, because you are a member of what?
The AIPLA, which is the largest association of intellectual property attorneys in the world. They have a lot of great free information, so you can go look there for free information. You can also go to loc.gov, which is the Library of Congress. Our federal government puts out a ton of great information, very well done, for authors and artists and such to learn about copyrights and how to protect your rights. So if to protect your rights, you have to know your rights. Okay, so go out there and do your research and get that stuff copyrighted. File your application, because without a registration, you got no case.
And Bill will be happy to talk to you. How do they reach you, Bill?
Best is to go to my website, larsonpatentlaw.com. As intellectual property attorneys, we do trademarks, patents, and copyrights. So it's Larson, L-A-R-S-O-N, patentlaw.com. And there's an email box there. You can send me your questions or comments, and I'll answer them.
Okay. Well, Bill, thank you again.
My pleasure.
It's always so much fun to have you in here. And to help our authors out there, there's so much that they have to go through, so many things they have to think about, and it's so nice that, you know, that you come in here and help them and start them thinking. Get the lawyer first. I can tell you from personal experience. Not only get the lawyer first, get a good lawyer, because Bill is. Larson & Larson, you're always winning awards and getting all sorts of wonderful things.
Thank you.
Said about Larson & Larson. He knows what he's doing, and that's the important thing. I had a young lawyer who was more impressed with the other side's lawyer than me. You know, don't do that. Get somebody like Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. Again, Bill, thanks so much for coming in today. It's been a joy to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Okay. Bye, and we'll see you next month.
See you next month.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay, we're going to go to commercial, okay?
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website, at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and I'm just waiting for a call from a very interesting author, and I am so excited to talk to her because she was sent to me by Kim from LA, and I love Kim from LA. Hi, Georgiana.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, well, I have on the phone Georgiana Marie, and she has written a fantastic book, and it's called Improv for Writers, 10 Secrets to Help Novelists and Screenwriters Bypass Writer's Block and Generate Infinite Ideas. Woo, I like it. How are you, Georgiana?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I was so thrilled to get... I just love Kim from L.A. She's such a kick. She sent me a personal note. She said, "Hi, Patsy. I think you will love this book." And she sent me your book. And she's right. I do love it. So it's so good to have you on the phone and talking here on Joy on Paper.
And I appreciate it. I love the show. I love the idea. I just love the title. I mean,
well,
why not?
You know, that's what when I was thinking of doing, you know, a radio show, everybody would probably think of using their name and whatever. But for me, I wanted it to be joy on paper, not just the joy of writing, but also the joy of reading. And for people to understand... It is so exciting when you first start to write and you see your words on paper and you sit back and you say, "I did that. I wrote that." Ah, you know, it's
yes.
Isn't it a thrill?
Yes. It is. It is. And the thing with this book is it's really instant gratification because the exercises have you writing in within minutes.
It is a fun book to read. And before I start, are you related to Annette Marie?
No, I'm not.
But you do her audio.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if she does the same thing, but Marie is my middle name that became my stage name.
Well, that was funny. She writes. She's a very good writer of fantasy, and I saw it. I thought, well, maybe she's your sister. I don't know, but...
Well, I would love that. If I had a fantasy writer for a sister, I think things would have been... Well, things were already pretty interesting.
Well, she's an excellent writer, and of course, you do her Audible books, and you do them beautifully, because you are an award-winning, we have to tell people, you are an award-winning narrator, you're a screenwriter, you're... Well, tell us, what are you? You are everything here.
I'm everything. We are all everything. We are tiny universes. I narrate a lot of audiobooks. It's getting into the hundreds, and I consider myself very fortunate to have broken into this world, and I just love getting to narrate other people's words and tell stories for a living, whether writing them or telling bringing other characters that people have been creating to life. It's really a joyful experience.
It is, and it's a joy to listen to you. You have a wonderful voice, and I was never very fond of Audible books, I'll admit, until I listened to Nicholas Guy Smith read Amor Towles' A Gentleman in Moscow. And I so fell in love with that reading. After that, I've been listening a lot to Audible books, and you have one of the loveliest voices for a book.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a similar thing for me, too. I think, you know, certain narrators can really break things open for us. Catherine Kellgren was one of the first people I listened to, and I was just floored. And I love listening to audiobooks. I'm an avid listener myself, and recording the audiobook for my own was really, it was very surreal, very interesting. After doing so many for other people and then going into the booth and sitting down, and I got to work with really good friends on it, and so it was just an unexpected, you know, I didn't know that we'd be doing an audiobook for this book because it is so unusual with the games and everything.
It is.
I hope people like it. I had a lot of fun doing it.
Well, tell us about the book. Where'd you get the idea? Improv for writers.
Well, my background is, as you know, to be an audiobook narrator, a lot of times we're trained actors, and my background is as an actress, and I, in order to, you know, as part of my journey, I've been teaching improv for many years. So I've taught so many different kinds of students, from beginners to very experienced and award-winning actors. I've taught them improv and acting. And I just saw that the things that we struggled with in the improv games when we were in doing shows or in class were the things that we struggled with in life. And I realized, wow, improv is something that's really elastic. It's something that can be adjusted and changed. And then I was asked if I would teach a workshop for writers and at Scriptwriters Network, and which is a nonprofit organization. And I pitched this idea, and they liked it. And then I did it, and people responded, and that was the beginning of it.
Well, it is a fascinating book, and I want to say to authors out there, you know, there are a lot of books about writing, and there's a lot of, you know, that you sort of get confused sometimes, but I would highly recommend this for several reasons. But one of them is the fact that you get into this whole thing of authors have to learn to speak. They have to learn to talk. They have to learn to express themselves off of the paper. And that's what you're doing here for them.
Yes, in a no pressure kind of way as well, and thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. So yeah, in the exercises, you know, I gently urge through. You know, we sort of build towards it. I urge authors to, you know, navigate their way into becoming the character, and we do this anyway. We don't always realize it. I just take it a step further sometimes, and ask authors to do that too. It's really a book for exploring and discovering, and I never set out to write a book on, you know, becoming a writer. It sounds so lofty. This is really just a chance to explore and play and really surprise yourself. And I'm constantly amazed by students when they're doing this material, and, you know, we use a timer and coming up with things within 30 seconds that, you know, hadn't been there before, and things that you're like, oh, I didn't know I had that story and that idea in me, and well, there it is, and we came up with it in 2 minutes flat.
Well, I think it's very cleverly done. I love the exercises. I love the all of the in the back of the book, you have all of these lists. I love lists. I'm like a crazy person for lists. I probably read the list before I read the book, because the minute I see an appendix list, I say, I have to read everything. I'm like, I love lists. I love lists.
Me too.
You know, it comes from sort of, I'm a natural teacher. I homeschool my boys, and I was always making lists for them. And I think it's a great way to learn things. So what secrets do you want to share today? Because I have a feeling I'm going to have you back, because there's so much in this book. But let's talk about what are some of the secrets that you want to talk about today?
Well, I think an important one is about criticism, and I think that it's easy to run into criticizing our material, whether in the moment or even years later after we've written it. And improv actually helps with criticism, because you do something in the moment, you make a decision to commit and it's one of the rules of improv, and it's a very important one, to decide to, I'm going to do this with everything I have. And once you do that, you're safe from looking back at the material and going, oh, how could I? Because you know that you made the decision to give it everything that you have, and it's this magic net that's right there for you. It's a safety net, and it happens. There's a thing that happens with actors when they do auditions or they do performances sometimes, is we just get in the car and kind of bang our heads on the steering wheel and go like, oh, I have the answer now. Why didn't I do this? Or why didn't I do that? Or how could I? And this. And sometimes we book the job and it's like, what? And actors who do improv do that a lot less. There's a lot less like looking back, hindsight, what did I do, beating ourselves up. And I think it's from creating a lot and throwing it away, creating a lot and using that, and then just not looking back at what it was and putting labels on it and trying to decide, oh, this is good. It's like on to the next exercise. And when you do that a lot and you're just writing prolifically and you're, you know, creating prolifically, then you're not judging what you came up with. You're not judging as much what other people came up with. You're just like, hey, we all put art in the world. Look at us. And I think that's an important thing.
Well, when I was going through the book, I stopped at, you know, some of the different, they're like games that really help people to think about things. And one of the ones I liked was the alphabet game. Tell us about that one.
That's one of my favorite games. I was like, oh, I have to put this in here somehow. So the alphabet game is played, when it's played on stage, you get the idea for a scene and the characters and all that. And the first person who speaks starts with a certain letter of the alphabet. In the beginning, the first time you play it, probably you start with the letter A. So I would start a sentence that begins with a word that begins with the letter A. And then you would say something that begins with the letter B for your sentence. And we go back and forth. You get one sentence or even one long run-on sentence if you want. And then we go through the alphabet as far as we can. When we mess up, somebody else jumps in and tags us out and takes our place, you know, or the audience makes noise or whatever. So I translated this for writers, and you write out a scene. You create two characters, and you write out a scene doing that. And it's really fun. So it's like if we were doing a scene and I was going to say something, I could name you, or I could start it with anything. I could say, Annie, it's so great to have you here at the party. Thanks for bringing the cheese doodles. And then you'd say something.
Yeah.
And then we go back and forth like that. But when you're writing, you just do it all yourself. So you decide for the characters, and you have a timer. So you're trying to just go as quickly as you can. And sometimes things will come up, you know, and I think it's important to notice when you're playing these games if certain things keep coming up. Like if you decide, oh, you keep stopping the timer, or you keep stopping yourself, that's important to know, because you're probably doing that in your writing, just like an actor would be doing that in their life, maybe stopping themselves when they had an idea they wanted to share. Maybe because for whatever reason they didn't think it was valuable, or they were criticizing themselves. These are all very human things. We all do them.
Well, I think one of the best things about this book is your enthusiasm. That, and I'm sure that people will just get such a kick out of seeing you in person at book signings and events, because you are such an enthusiastic person. And let's play. Here's one of your games, or part of one of your things is set the timer for 10 minutes and begin listing the stories you connected to the most, or the books of your childhood. So what are the books that were important to you as a child?
Oh, I loved Pollyanna. I loved a lot of Disney. I loved a lot of Disney shows, because it's books and shows. But I was an avid reader. I read everything that I could get my hands on. If I didn't have something, I would be reading the phone book. But I read a lot of Nancy Drew.
Oh, yeah.
And so I read a lot of those things. I think the thing, and that's the reason that's in there. I was funny you brought this up, because I was also thinking about this morning. I think those things that we think of and dream about when we're kids are really important. And that's part of why that's in there. But I think that sometimes those dreams like really can come true. And it's kind of an amazing feeling when they do. It's like, oh, this is life. this is it. It's kind of funny because some of those things have happened for me, like narrating the Nancy Drew series was, I mean, it's just unreal. And then getting to, you know, to write some episodes for Disney and to be there and to voice for them too. It's all been amazing. And those are the things I dreamed about when I was a child. So, and there's different reasons to revisit that. It's also to remind us of our sensibilities. And when there's a lot of truth in children and what they're drawn to, and things can really hit us hard when we're kids and we don't forget them. So I think a lot of people, when you ask them, people even listening now are thinking, oh, when I was a kid, I remember. And I think it's important to note because it's our earliest taste, you know, what we were drawn to. We knew even as kids that we liked certain things. And that's, I think it's important to have in our pocket.
And to keep trying different things, it's as you're actor, narrator, writer, and it's just so wonderful if people just keep trying. And I just recently had on my program Eugenia Lovett West, and she's 96 years old.
Oh wow!
And she got married in 1944. I mean, you don't meet too many people who. You know, not only that she remember everything. I mean, she just wrote a absolutely fantastic book. She's absolutely amazing. But she talks about her wedding in 1944, like it was yesterday. You know, she knows all the details and everything. And this is you don't know what's going to happen. So it's so exciting that you just grab on and keep trying. And she wanted to be a writer when she was young, and then life interfered and all of the things. And then she started writing only in her 80s. So,
wow.
Isn't it?
Wow.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's so wonderful. And she's not alone, too. I mean, there are a lot of people. Louise Hay, who created Hay House, didn't start until she was a bit over 50. And it's like, you know, these women and men who do this, it's very inspiring to me because it's very important to know that it's there. You just have to make that decision to do it and to try. And I love that she also knew that when she was a kid, she wanted to write too. I did as well. I started a novel, and I just wanted to be Stephen King. I read so many Stephen King books. I wanted to go live off in the woods. So. It's funny. I can't watch horror movies now unless they're like horror comedy. It's like our tastes do change, but like I was very clear about, like I had wanted to be a writer. And actually, when I first time I walked on stage in high school, I thought after the performance, I thought, like my plans have been derailed because I love performing. And that was a weird feeling because I was so situated in I'm a writer and I'm going to be living with paper underneath my hands for the rest of my life. But I found a way to combine them. And I think that's what women like that have done too. It's like, you know, derailed, but all of that, it really is all just material that works into and is like a, you know, something for all of us to pull from. You know, I've done stand-up for years and I stopped touring and I was like, well, what did I do all that for years for? And it's like, no, that's a pretty strong, solid skill and I still do it. I just don't do it as much because I want to devote time to, you know, what I love about writing is I think you need to give yourself space to do it. So time alone, blocks of time, even if it's a 5-minute block, but just space to create for yourself. And that's important in this world where everybody's kind of distracted or people are grabbing at your attention and to go, no, I want to honor this thing that people have been doing for so long, for, you know, eons, this making space for themselves to come up with parts of a story.
Well, I hope that one of the things that will inspire the writers who read this book, the writers who are the ones who, you know, they're in their little world, they're in their little cubby hole, they're writing away, and they're having so much fun, and you have so much fun when you're writing, and you really enjoy it. But so many of them get so terrified coming out of that hole, coming, having to face people, having to, and nowadays you have to promote your own books. Nobody's going to do it. Even the best-selling authors, publishing houses do not go out there and promote your books. You have to go out there. And for many authors, this is the worst part of being an author. But you make it fun.
Oh, I hope so. And that's part of why I wrote this book. It was for, you know, I started as I, more, so many of my friends are writers, and sometimes there is these other aspects. And I thought, as actors, so many of us improv actors, we're so free. We're like, la, la, la. And I can talk about anything all day long. And so I think there are a lot of tools in here that can be helpful if there are writers out there struggling with that, because it does not need to be a struggle. It can be a really fun, playful thing. And that's what it's about, is kind of shaking things loose. And knowing that you can come up with a whole bunch of things in a matter of minutes is also, like, for the very pragmatic person, is just, it's very, there's a lot of logic to it, too. I try to do every game with, like, okay, this is a weird thing I'm asking you to do, maybe, but here's why we're doing it. Here's what you're going to get out of
it. And it works.
Because you're going to get something out of it.
Well, I don't know if you're doing a lot of workshops yet for writers, but I'm sure you will be invited to, like, every writers conference, and be invited to do workshops to help writers, because they do need help. I mean, I have to help authors. So often I will get an author, and they will be shy when they start my program, and they're like, And that's part of my job. I try to make them laugh. I try to make them calm down. I try to make them, you know, articulate what they want to say. And it's so much fun to see even the change, little change that I sometimes can get out of an author.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, well, when we're writing, you know, sometimes this is a very important thing to us. It's very precious. And I think when you start to think about, there's a lot of different ways you could tell the story. There's a lot of different characters that can come in, and actually it's infinite. It starts to release the pressure. And so your aspect of when you're teaching and working with writers of being playful is important, because when you're being playful, you're off guard. And that's when, like, really cool stuff sneaks in there, and you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay, I was just playing this game, but whoa, this is good. I'm using this.
Exactly.
Like, this is an idea that I came up with that I wouldn't have otherwise. This is in.
Well, the name of the book is Improv for Writers. It's got a very nice cover. I like it. And what's your website so people can go and look at it?
Oh, okay, so it's Georgina Marie, but it's with.
I love J's. The spelling. I love it.
So it throws people off. It's JORJEANA, but Georgina Marie and .com. And I'm redoing a website, so I'm going to have some more, like, some actual content on there, too, that goes along with the book. So watch out for that.
Great. Well, people have to just remember Jordache. You have to go around wearing Jordache jeans and say, you know, I'm related to this company. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
easy way to remember, because once you see it, it's absolutely, I think it's delightful. And I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, because the book is joyful. You're a joy to talk to. And I want to thank Kim of LA, because I love the personal note. This is something why Kim is such a special publicist. I get a lot of things. Sometimes people just send me a book and they don't say anything, you know, like, really, you're going to like this author, like Kim does. And so that's what you need in a publicist. You need somebody enthusiastic, and you need an author like you who's enthusiastic. And I am now judging authors. I think I'm saying, are you Kim from L.A. worthy? <You
know. laughs> Yeah, she's great.
Isn't she?
And enthusiasm is key, yeah.
She's amazing. And she has a client list. People, you have to just go to Kim of LA and look at her client list. But Georgina Marie, I am so happy that you were on Joy on Paper today.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
It's an absolute joy to be with you. Thank you so much.
Okay, and the book is available wherever books are sold. And go to Georgina's website, and I'm sure she's going to put up some samples. And maybe she'll... Well, because you're very funny. You are very funny. I looked at some of your improv work, and you are absolutely absolutely hilarious.
I'm a goofball. Thank you.
Exactly. Just what we need in life. We need somebody to put a smile on our face, and you certainly do it. So, again, thank you so much for being on the program today. And I think I'll invite you back again so that we can keep the enthusiasm going for authors, okay?
I would love that. Thank you, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Woo! She's funny. Oh, she's so cute. And I was looking at some of her YouTube videos, and she's hilarious. She's absolutely hilarious and delightful. And speaking of Kim of L.A., really do go. If you have been disappointed with your publicity package, and so many authors are disappointed, yeah, really have to check out Kim of L.A. I mean, she is amazing. First of all, I had no idea until I looked at her that Robert Bly is one of her, she represented, I don't know, amazing poet. And, of course, she's Robert Grace's publicist. She's just something. What she does is she has enthusiasm. And, you know, I get, just today I walked in, I had a whole pile of books. I will go through them. And most of them, none of the publicists will actually write a personal note. None of them will say why I should look at this book. None of them will say, oh, Patsy, you're going to really love this book. They just send the book. And, you know, I find out which ones I like. I read them. But I like when a publicist is cheerful and enthusiastic, and Kim is certainly that, and her whole firm, everybody in the firm is wonderful, but she's very impressive, and Robert Crace always says that when she does a publicity campaign, she really knows what she's doing, and she plans it out, and she works with an author to get it right. And so if you think you are Kim of L.A. worthy, not everybody is worthy of Kim of you got to be really good, you might check her out and see if you have a book, it's out there and it hasn't been doing anything, you might want to contact Kim of LA and see what she can do for you, because somebody has to do something. And between Kim and some of Georgiana Marie's advice, never know, you might get your book out there again on track to be a bestseller. Meanwhile, remember what I tell you all the time. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're lucky, to hear the words lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture, or a wonderful, wonderful Hallmark Channel show series like Carol J. Perry's is going to be one day. That's what I'm keeping my fingers crossed, because I think she's worthy of a great series. And then say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And check out Kim of LA's website. I think you will find it intriguing. Okay, bye-bye now.